Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. Coming up on today's show, we'll be joined by Howard Meetner. Howard is a managing director at Karl Marx Advisors. He's also the former CEO, the first CEO, in fact, of Sephora USA and oversaw their growth. He's been a leader at many retail companies. He joins us today to talk about some intriguing things going on in the world of commercial real estate as far as malls are concerned, and also some steps that retailers perhaps could take if they're in a struggling mall to maybe turn themselves around or draw in additional traffic. We'll also talk with him about the scope of a CEO's responsibilities as it pertains to growing a company like he did with Sephora USA, or maybe rescuing a company as he did with the museum store when he was the CEO there. We'll also discuss sporting goods retail, and Big Lots wraps up their fiscal year with an earnings call this week. A reminder that you can rate us on any podcast listening service that you happen to access us on. Those ratings do help others find the show. So if you like us, go ahead, give us a rating. We would much appreciate that. And we appreciate all those that have given us ratings to this point. Additionally, you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram. So let's get it started with the news segment here. Big Lots, as I mentioned, they wrap up their fiscal year with fourth quarter earnings this week. They ended up beating on analyst estimates by about 6%, but it's not so much the bottom line for Q4 that we're looking at here. We're looking at several of their initiatives going forward, and they dropped a few hints during the call that they might actually be shifting into a growth phase after kind of teasing folks for the last few years. Now, during the pandemic, to kind of set the stage for this, Big Lots continued their shift towards a general merchandise type model rather than a bargain hunt or off-price model. They do still have some of that off-price in their stores, and of course, that's their heritage, as the company will tell you, but they want to be more of a neighborhood general merchandise retailer with that furniture aspect built in. Furniture, of course, such a big driver of sales for Big Lots, and that really differentiates them from, say, a Family Dollar or a Dollar General. And during most of 2020, it paid off with modest comps, although their comps for this last quarter came in slightly behind the likes of Dollar General and General Merchandise and behind Ollie's and Off Price, but still on the balance, a very good year for 2020. And the company wrapped up the year by being bullish about their growth prospects in 2021, really what we wanted to talk about here, including their desire to shift back into expansion mode with those new locations. Now, before we get into that, let's address those fourth quarter results. Results from the quarter, at least on the sales front, did scale back somewhat compared to their results from the previous three quarters. Net sales grew 8.1%. Comps provided 7.9% in a year-over-year increase. Home categories for them were the main driver of comps. You look at window dressings, up 35%. Home organization, up 25% year-over-year. Bed and bath, up 20% in terms of comps. Furniture, also up big time. We'll talk about that in a few moments as well. And when you look at that difference between net sales and comps, you might think that that 0.2% difference was as a result of newly opened stores, but that's not the case. You see, they actually averaged throughout the quarter fewer stores than a year ago. That doesn't mean they finished the quarter with less stores. They actually ended up a slight net positive over last year at the end of the fourth quarter. However, they did see a slight benefit from two things. One was the relocation of several stores to better or more ideal locations, not only demographically, but also in terms of size. Big Lots, one of those few retailers, and we talk so often about retailers trying to downsize and free up real estate. Big Lots going the other way because furniture takes up so much room and it's been such a big driver. Now, these stores not included in comps where they were relocating. And then the second thing is the opening of new stores, which despite not outpacing closures, did provide more robust sales than their closed stores had. They feel as though every new store they open really hits the ground running in terms of their sales, and that showed up in their net sales numbers of the fourth quarter. And now the second point, of course, opening stores, those stores do really well. That seems like an obvious one. We should keep in mind that that hasn't historically been the case for all retailers, especially as they transition their brick-and-mortar footprint into larger areas. And so this means that Big Lots is not only making prudent decisions in terms of which stores they're closing, but also doing a great job of marketing their new stores and doing that market research beforehand. Of course, we've got an interesting interview, by the way, lined up in a couple of weeks. We'll talk to commercial real estate expert Bruce Milton in a few weeks on the podcast about that research that takes place prior to opening a new brick and mortar store for a retailer. In any case, back to the earnings. For the full year, Big Lots ended with a comp increase of 16.1%. Pretty solid, of course, and a net sales increase of 16.5%. They were a major beneficiary early on in the pandemic. Their Q2 and Q3 were outstanding. But this initial impact waned, as it did for so many in the general merchandise space. They also cost themselves a little bit with holiday sales. We'll talk about that in a moment as well. Inventory was up slightly to end the year too, about 2%. But there's a big caveat here. This increase was driven by what they term in-transit inventory. The company said on the call that this was necessary and had been necessary throughout the year to scale up their in-transit inventory as they pivot to general merchandise, as they try to keep in stocks at a high level. But the reason there's so much of this inventory tied up in transit rather than being on the shelves is a function of their upstream supply chain. So before it even gets to Big Lots, being overwhelmed somewhat. A much longer lead time on imported merchandise is a big factor. And they continue to attempt to claw back to those same in-stock levels as a year ago. And to wit, if one just looks at their on-hand inventory, it's actually down 5% versus on-hand inventory at the end of fiscal 2019. So what's on-hand, whether it be in their DCs or in their stores, that's actually down over a year ago, and that's what hit their Christmas seasonal so hard. They blame the relative lack of this in-store inventory for year-over-year Christmas seasonal sales declining. They actually, going into the Christmas season, decided to limit their Christmas buys somewhat. They saw an early sell-through, so that left a lot of shelves bare as the holiday came around, and it led them to take a 12% negative year-over-year hit in this category. So for all the things they did right in the quarter, buying for seasonal was not one of them. They did mention on the call, and they were asked about this as well on the earnings call by an analyst regarding their spring seasonal buying. And they said, yeah, they learned from their mistakes. They ramped up that buying for the spring season, and it's doing quite well so far in January and February. But as I mentioned, the reason we're discussing them in the first place, and the most interesting part of the call, was CEO Bruce Thorne's comments regarding store count growth in 2021. In an atmosphere, as I mentioned, where not many retailers are discussing growing their overall square footprint, whether that's on a single store basis or whether that's opening new stores, Big Lots did surprise us somewhat here. And we've known that this was their eventual plan. We've actually poked fun in the past at their investor relations tagline, position for growth, for some time, because for several years, they've actually been going the opposite direction. They've been downsizing, whether it be exiting unprofitable locations or exiting Canada entirely a few years back. They've seen a slight net positive in terms of store openings each of the last couple of years, but nothing that would really raise any eyebrows. Thorne said on the call, they have a desire now to accelerate their new store openings along with a few other initiatives. Part of that is because of their success in terms of that movement to general merchandise and an increased general merchandise position in 2020. They also expect to curtail closures, so that's going to help in terms of the net new store openings. They've been pretty successful in renegotiating leases in certain locations, so they're able to keep those stores open. And during the financial portion of the call, CFO Jonathan Ramsden went so far as to say, and I quote this, "We continue to believe that unit growth can be a major driver of our performance," and he even hinted at bigger plans surrounding openings in the future. And along with this, they want to explore alternative store formats, something that they've already dipped their toes into a little bit with their Store of the Future layout they rolled out a few years back. But again, they're not set on just, hey, the traditional store format or even the Store of the Future layout. They want to tinker around with different things because they feel like certain layouts might be successful in certain markets. Now, to put a number to this expansion, 50 to 60 new stores are expected in 2021. That's spread evenly throughout the U.S., with around 20 relocations to move to a larger square footage to accommodate that furniture expansion. Speaking of furniture expansion, they want to continue to grow their partnership with Broyhill as they continue to expand their square footprint. And the Broy Hill partnership, something we've talked about in the past, but it really did make a positive impact this quarter. And they needed it, especially with that negativity surrounding seasonal, significant momentum overall in furniture during 2021, but particularly in Q4, furniture comps grew 15%. And that's despite overall comps, as we mentioned, being up around 8%. Broy Hill specifically represented 17% of their furniture sales in Q4. 30% of this was upholstery. Home office also such a good Q4, doubled year over year. Upholstery, by the way, up 20% if we're looking at subcategories. Now, a couple of their other initiatives as they go forward, they plan on the expanded rollout of their lot, or what they call the lot, which is kind of a value area, and their Q line, which is a front-end program, as well as their e-commerce position. Just briefly on each, they want the lot in about 90% of their stores by 2021's, and the same with the Q line, and that has the added benefit of freeing up prime square footage in the front end of their stores. As I mentioned, that is a front-end initiative, and the front end at Big Lots has been known to be a little bit sloppy in the past. They're shoring it up. If you've ever been to one of their Q line locations, it's a drastic difference and I think a much better layout than a lot of their traditional stores. And then speaking of e-commerce, their e-commerce sales up about 130% year over year for this quarter, but they're still trying to upscale here. Currently, as an example, they have shipped from store in 47 locations. And they went on the call about how they're able to reach 90% of the country with two-day delivery because of the ship from store setup, but they would like to expand that program to continue to hasten shipping times for customers, try to keep up with the Joneses in this e-commerce category. But overall, again, Big Lots looking at the next few years, seeking to expand their overall store count, seeking to expand furniture in the stores, and really, they're kind of working their way into an area where they have a unique proposition. They've got some off-price aspects still in the stores, of course, a lot of furniture in the stores. And then outside of that, just a general merchandise retailer more and more these days when you go into a Big Lots. And although it's not a plan necessarily that I would be first in line to get behind, it does seem to be working for Big Lots. And as long as people continue to invest in their home and continue to invest in these stay-at-home categories, Big Lots could indeed be positioned for growth. But something that gives me a little bit of pause is knowing that people won't be staying in their homes too much longer, ideally, with the vaccine coming out and rolling out continuously to an expanded audience. And one would think that eventually spending will kind of return to categories that it was going to prior to the pandemic. So it is interesting to hear Big Lots talking about going all in on some of these stay-at-home categories and other comments on the call. And you wonder if that can be successful as you look ahead to, say, 2022 or 2023. But either way, even though they're lapping a very good 2020, you can see where Big Lots is positioned for success, particularly in seasonal. They pointed this out as an area of growth because of their lacking inventory for the last couple of seasons. They feel like if they can ramp up seasonal with all these new customers, with all of these new loyalty program customers, they'll be in a great position in 2021 to perform even better than they did in 2020. That'll do it for our news segment. Coming up after this, we'll be joined by Howard Meetner, once again, a managing director at Karl Marx Advisors and the former president and CEO of Sephora USA. Howard will talk about not only dynamics in the mall space for mall-based retailers, but the difference in terms of leading a company out of a tough spell and leading a company to growth from practically nothing. If you listen to this podcast, you're probably well aware of the changes shopping malls have experienced in the U.S. over the past 10 years, but some changes go beyond what meets the eye, and moreover, there are things that malls could or should be doing, even during a pandemic, to maintain both occupancy and relevancy in the eyes of the consumer. Here to discuss these issues is Howard Meetner, a managing director at Karl Marx Advisors. Howard is the former president and CEO of the Museum Company and also former president and CEO of Sephora USA. Howard, welcome to the show today.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
First, I gave just a brief introduction, but I was wondering if you could give our listeners a bit more of a background regarding yourself and your retail experience so we know a bit more about the perspective you bring to today's conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I started life out in the department store industry in the UK with a group called Debenhams, which is now sadly liquidated. And then I moved to Hong Kong in the late 70s with a company called Duty Free Shoppers. And we were a very large business in the travel retail sector. And we were bought in the mid 90s by the Louis Vuitton Hennessy Group. And acquisition, LVMH had also bought Sephora. And it was that led me to the domestic US retail business as CEO to launch the concept in the USA. And then really since then, I've been focusing on retail turnarounds, both as a CEO and interim CEO, and then with turnaround and advisory groups like Karl Marx.
Before we get to talking a little bit more about malls, I was just curious because you do have such a breadth of retail experience. You oversaw massive growth at Sephora USA. And as you mentioned, you helped oversee turnarounds as well. From a retail CEO's perspective, what are the differences there between navigating a company through explosive growth and navigating a company maybe through a bankruptcy or an attempt at a turnaround?
Well, the benefit of doing a turnaround is that you come into the challenge at a later point. So you have no authorship over what's happened before, and you can see with great clarity what needs to be done, both in terms of the problems that exist within an organization and the challenges it faces either with disruption in the marketplace or with competition. Whereas when you're doing a startup, it's all unknown. If you think for a Sephora revolutionary concept at the time when we introduced it into the US, and although Bernard Arnault was very clear in the fact that he knew that Sephora was going to be a success, the journey of success was not laid out, and you constantly have to pivot and change as some of your execution strategies perform better than you thought or how to meet expectations. There's quite a significant difference.
So you mentioned it, pivot and change, and we've seen a lot of that certainly in the mall and shopping center space over the past 10 years. As you look back at the past 10 years, what are some changes that you've seen from your perspective that might not be obvious when looking at the mall or shopping center space from afar?
Well, perhaps a little controversially, I would suggest there hasn't been enough change. It's a bit like the department store business. You know, there's been some dynamic forces at play in online businesses and in different formats, and some formats are becoming less attractive to the consumers and consumer behavior changing. So I would say one of the problems with the shopping malls is they've been slow to react. What COVID has done is simply accelerate the trends that were already there. So, you know, people talk about the reduction of customer traffic into shopping malls. Well, that's been happening for the last 10 years as people and people's habits have changed. So I think there's some very creative, very interesting things happening now. But just like with department stores and other concepts that struggled, these changes should have really been occurring at a much faster pace some time ago. You have so many examples of businesses that didn't change and they got left behind. You know, and we've seen that through history. I mean, this is not just happening now. I mean, look at what happened to Blockbuster, HMV, all of these things. And you could, in every era, you can see how change left people who didn't respond behind. You know, a good example is how anchor tenants used to draw people to malls and how the attraction of those anchor tenants diminished over the last 5-10 years. There's some very interesting research out there, isn't there? There was one I just saw where 72% of people used to buy apparel in stores. They're now saying only 55% plan to in a post-COVID environment. I'm not sure that's true, but you can see that malls and retailers are going to have to work very, very hard to turn this thing around.
You mentioned the topic of change, and I know the struggles of certain malls certainly have been well publicized, but there are some A-class malls, not certainly the majority of malls in the U.S., but some A-class malls have retained a solid presence, solid occupancy, pretty good traffic, even throughout the pandemic. What have successful malls done that perhaps some of the B and C class malls haven't been able to do? Is it a matter of them simply pivoting and changing more frequently or doing so ahead of the other malls?
I think it's to do with demographics. A lot of these A-class malls benefit from being in a location that has an abundance of their target demographic. The patience and financial fortitude of many of their tenants allows them to go through the swings and roundabouts of the retail budget calendar. But I think they've also been lucky in that there hasn't really been a profound impact at the luxury end of the market as there has been in the middle section of the market. So a lot of these A-class malls have concepts and brands that have longevity. But I think the thing they've also done, and I'd like to make a point here, that we talk about shopping malls as shopping malls. And I think I'd like to suggest that that name is out of date, because I don't think it's any longer an accurate description of what these centers are. I think it's going to be less and less accurate as a description as we go forward. And I think we should be thinking more about these A-class malls and others being referred more to gallerias where there's a promise of something more than just a shopping experience.
And of course, we talked to someone with the Washington Prime Group a few weeks ago saying they prefer town centers as the description there for some of their shopping centers. But I want to kind of frame my next question through that lens. You know, there's been talk about the importance of malls adding more experiential aspects to retain traffic, whether you call them town centers or gallerias or what have you. You're talking experiential retail, generally speaking. You know, we're in the middle of the pandemic where some things necessarily have to take a back seat on the experiential front. I was wondering, how can properties bridge the gap between the experiential and the safe in 2021? And how have you seen retailers do that with success?
Well, there's some phenomenal innovation that is being done, which many entrepreneurs need to be given credit for. I mean, first of all, there is a growing number of technologies that allow people within a store to experience their purchasing opportunity without even touching or trying on product anymore. And I think it adds to the experience. A lot of people are more digitally native now than they were before. So they come into stores and there's touchscreen technologies, there's laser technologies, there's augmented reality technologies that will allow customers not only to be able to have a shopping experience, but to be able to make their choices in a safe way. I think visible hygiene is going to be important. I think controlling the number of people in stores so that people don't feel overcrowded is important, and providing alternatives for people whilst they're awaiting access. So what people have experienced over the last 12 months, and with all the benefit that that's seen to online, is they crave physical engagement and they crave a return to a more balanced mental health situation. So I think they're going to be coming into malls for the experience, for a range of services, and for those services to be delivered in new and impactful ways. And there's lots of things happening that will assist that. I was just involved in a turnaround on a restaurant bar business. And, you know, it's been hit very hard, and we successfully sold the business last June. But here's the interesting thing, talking about how there's so much pent-up demand to get back and have physical experiences. So right now we have a few locations which are operating. We have over 50 around the country, but there's a few that are operating at 50% capacity because of local state rules. They're doing more in terms of sales than they were doing in 2019. On 50%. So you have to ask yourself what, and I think what we're going to see, Trent, is a huge resurgence of people wanting environments that provide for hygiene and safety. So I'm an optimist actually about retail coming back and being strong, but they won't do well if they're just going to provide the same service and the same things as they did before. But just imagine how unsatisfactory the online buying experience is for a fashion product. So I think people are going to want to meet their friends, have a bite to eat, and then go and have some form of shopping and cultural experience. I think there's a pent-up demand, and I think we're going to see for the smart retailers. I mean, you look at what Kohl's have done with Sephora and Target with Ulta. I mean, there's some fantastic new strategic partnerships that are being formed or designed to make their shopping experience more interesting.
You mentioned earlier, of course, A-class malls benefiting somewhat from demographics and from some of their tenants. And we just talked about people craving that experience, especially coming out of the pandemic. Looking ahead over the next few years, of course, B and C class malls can't really change their demographics so much, but rather than slowly leaking their occupants or their retailers that they have, what are some of the things that these class of malls can or should do to maybe retain their relevance in the eyes of the consumer?
Well, if they forget the past and they shift, they pivot to this new paradigm, I think they need to re-examine who they are and what their attributes are. Most malls are very well located in terms of transportation access. They're also very well endowed with space to accommodate visitors in terms of parking, etc. So as long as they are not trying to go backwards, they can do any number of things. I mean, we've seen some more spaces being developed into fulfillment centers. You yourselves have spoken about some medical centers occupying space in these malls. Co-working spaces where you have the benefit of an engaged local community who can take advantage of other services in the mall. Adding office residential, looking at what customers are looking for whilst they're out and about, whether it's daycare, pet care, or what have you, and reaching out beyond confines of the existing malls. I mean, this is the classic thinking outside the box. Well, it's thinking outside the malls. Some of the things that these B&C malls are doing with their parking spaces, what we're seeing with dining being allowed to migrate outwards into open air spaces as well. So these malls are really only limited by their imagination, because there will be a myriad of new uses that people or companies would be willing to engage with these landlords on. And it can become a 1+1+1, because the more people that you bring to one of these centers, the more you can develop services around them and catering to the unique needs of those local communities. So I see the future being very different from the past, but no less relevant in terms of servicing the geography surrounding these centers.
So just went in-depth as far as what some of these shopping centers, these malls, can do to kind of reimagine themselves over the next few years. I want to look at it from the retailer's perspective because, again, you have a very lengthy career in terms of retail turnarounds and assisting retailers in turnarounds. Let's say you're the CEO of a mall-based retailer that is struggling. You've got a lot of long-term leases sitting out there. Where do you start from the retailer's perspective?
I think you're in trouble. I think, you know, the problem right now in the US, and probably not just the US, is there are far too many stores. And we can see in a broader sense that many, many companies are downsizing the number of locations that they have. And they're also looking with technology of reducing the average square footage of their stores so that they can reduce their rent liability and perhaps fulfill customer requests by delivering directly to their home following a store visit. One of the things that Best Buy did, which I thought was really smart, is they took some of their existing locations and probably will expand this to all their locations and converted half the space into a fulfillment center. So not only did they recognize they didn't need as much space for the actual merchandise, but this would then allow them to be able to provide a superior fulfillment service and timely delivery to their customers within that particular geography. So I think we're going to see some of that. But if I'm a retailer in a mall, if I have a clause in my lease about the tenants that are in there, the anchors, I'm going to try and renegotiate my lease. And I'm going to look to exit as many unprofitable locations as I can. And for some, that may mean filing for bankruptcy protection to do that. Although I think as long as landlords feel they can fill the space with other usage, there's probably going to be an accommodation. But definitely the retailer is in trouble right now in terms of the number of stores they have and the number that don't make money.
Once again, Howard Meetner, so much great insight. We appreciate you taking the time to join us on the podcast today.
It's been a pleasure.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we thank Howard for joining us and once again taking time out of his busy schedule to talk a little bit about what he's seeing in the real estate space and talk a little bit about his experience at the helm of certain companies. Now, in our looking ahead segment, kind of the reason I wanted to look towards sporting goods retail is that Hibbett Sports actually announced their latest quarterly earnings this last week, a slight beat over analyst expectations, about 3%, in fact, on analyst consensus estimates there. But I'm not so much looking at Hibbett, and I don't want to look so much behind at sporting goods retail, but I want to look ahead at what the next year might hold in store for the likes of Dick's, or Big Five, or Hibbett, or any other of the national or regional sports retailers. You see, after Hibbett had announced earnings on this call, they talked a little bit about the year ahead, where they expect growth, but it got me thinking, really. We saw an increase in people trying to get outside, especially during the summer, during the course of the pandemic, and now with some pandemic restrictions easing in certain areas throughout the country and expected to ease further going into the summer, what impact might that have on things like team sports? And so I canvassed a handful of people that own a very specific type of commercial real estate, that being basically indoor athletic centers, so places where volleyball might be played or places where softball training might take place, and just kind of canvassed them in different markets throughout the country, people I had met in the past, people I trusted, and they all told me the same thing, which is that even compared to pre-pandemic days, things are now booked solid. And it seems like both adult and youth are itching to get outside, kind of like what Howard Meetner talked about with apparel sales and people wanting to get out of the house and meet their friends and go out and socialize again. People are really chomping at the bit to play things like team sports again, where allowed, because for most of the country, for most of the last 12 months, it really wasn't allowed. And so given that, and knowing that these facilities are now booked months in advance, and you're seeing this massive flow towards recreation, certainly makes you think that it could be potentially an even better year for sporting goods retail than it was in 2020. We saw great earnings from Dick's. We saw great earnings and growth from Hibbett. And you really do wonder if you're going to see a massive flow towards these retailers, not just this summer, but also as you get into fall, the fall sports schedules for middle and high schools. I really do think has the potential to be a banner year for this area of retail. And of course, I've mentioned on the show before, this is an area of retail that I happen to be somewhat familiar with. But at the same time, given who we've talked to, given even the store managers that we've talked to with both Hibbett and Dick's and Big Five, you get the feeling like this could be a very big year for sporting goods retail and could indeed kind of change the scope of things in this space. And we've talked before about how difficult it is really in an e-commerce setting to have people buy things like, say, a baseball glove, where you really want to make sure that it fits before you buy it online. You want to make sure that it's something that you would prefer using. Same thing with golf clubs, same thing with a lot of athletic materials. And I really do think this is an area to watch, an area potentially for growth, just like Big Lots, in the brick and mortar sector as we head forward, not just to 2021, but also as they start to plan new store openings, or potential new store openings for 22 and 23. Well, that'll do it for Retail Focus Podcast this week. Coming up next week, there will be no weekend podcast, so we're going to drop our episode on Wednesday of this next week, and that episode will be timed relatively well because our interview guest is a man named Alan Payne. Alan, if you are unfamiliar with him, he is the author of an upcoming book, Built to Fail. It comes out this next week, in fact, Tuesday of this next week on the 9th. It chronicles Blockbuster's struggles over the last two decades of their company prior to declaring bankruptcy. Alan, by the way, oversaw one of the most successful Blockbuster franchise chains in the country. You could call it the most successful franchise chain for Blockbuster in the country in Border Entertainment. He'll talk about where Blockbuster could have gotten things right, and in hindsight, what they should have done to maybe not put themselves on a negative trajectory. These type of stories are stories I'm a firm believer they need to be told. We need to learn from our past, and so we're very excited to have Alan on the show discussing his book. And again, that will drop Wednesday, nothing this coming weekend. However, we look forward to that. I hope everyone has a great week ahead. We'll be back with you just a few days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.